left off last session, if you remember, I estimated country equity risk premiums for 160-plus countries, okay? Including some frontier markets like Syria and North Korea. So basically, we've got a... But let's face it, you're valuing a company, not an entire country. Unless you're valuing Aramco, in which case you are valuing an entire country. Because 80% of Saudi Arabia's GDP comes from Aramco. But in most cases, you're valuing a company. And to kind of lay the foundations for that, I'm going to start the class off by asking you questions about three very different companies with one common statistic. So here's the first one. You're valuing an Israeli software company. There's a lot of tech startups in Tel Aviv, right? But it gets 95% of its revenues in the U.S. and 5% of its revenues in Israel. It's headquartered, it's traded in Israel. And you're trying to estimate an equity risk premium for this company. So I'm going to give you some choices, and you tell me which one makes the most sense. You could use the Israeli equity risk premium, saying it's headquartered and traded in Israel. That's what I'm going to use. So if that's a choice you'd make, and I hope, you know, make that your choice. The second is you can say, look, it gets most of its revenue in the U.S., might as well just use the U.S. equity risk premium, or a weighted average of the two. This is like a slam dunk question because I've kind of worked really hard to set up the choices. How many of you would use the Israeli equity risk premium simply because it's headquartered and traded in Israel? Not a single person in this class. You know that the default position in valuation right now is that one, which is your risk premium comes from where your head, which is the most absurd thing I can ever think of, but it seems to be standard practice. In fact, German appraisal rules require you to use the equity risk premium of Germany for every German company, even if 100% of your revenues come from Afghanistan. Okay. So we're going to come back and talk about what may be causing that, the kinds of consequences of that practice. But I'm weighting by revenue, so let me push back. There are clearly differences being listed and trade in Israel as opposed to the U.S. There are differences in regulations, differences in laws. So why isn't that showing up in the equity risk premium? Shouldn't the equity risk premium be affected by those differences? Maybe, but there are more inputs in evaluation, right? Your margins, your cash flows. You have so many layers in evaluation. There are places you can show differences in regulation, places you can show different tax rates. The equity risk premium is not designed to carry that burden. In fact, the other argument, and this is a trickier one, is it might get 95% of its revenues in the U.S., but all of its software engineers are in Tel Aviv. And I don't seem to be factoring that in. I'll come back and talk about that, but that's something to factor in. The production is still in Tel Aviv. The production is of software, the people producing it. I seem to be focusing entirely on revenues. The second example is going to kind of set up the counter, and we're going to see how we navigate this divide. Second example is a Nigerian oil company, headquartered and traded in Nigeria, gets all of its oil in Nigeria, but sells 95% of that oil in the U.S. and 5% in Nigeria. Here, I'm going to ask you the same question. Should I use the Nigerian risk premium, the U.S. equity risk premium, or a weighted average based on revenues? If you're an autopilot, what are you going to do? You're going to use the revenue weights, right? But when you're investing in an oil company, and you think about the risk you face as an investor, is the risk coming from where you sell the oil? Remember, you sell oil into a global oil market, or from where you get the oil. I mean, when I think about oil companies, I think, well, where do you get your oil? But that's where the risk is going to come from. Here you could make an argument that your equity risk premium should just be the Nigerian equity risk premium, because where you get your revenues is kind of irrelevant. That's why when I valued Aramco, for those of you who did go through that valuation of the week, I used the Saudi Arabian equity risk premium. But the reality is almost all of their oil is sold outside Saudi Arabia, but that's where I think about risk when I think about an oil company. What if the Nigerian company delists in Lagos and relists on the NASDAQ? Will its equity risk premium now become the U.S. equity risk premium? I know it's an absurd question. Because delisting in Lagos and relisting on the NASDAQ doesn't make its oil reserves move from Nigeria to the U.S. But this was actually something that South African gold mining companies did about 25 years ago. They delisted in Johannesburg, relisted in London. I remember talking to the CEO of one of these companies. I said, why are you doing it? And he said, well, we want country risk to go away. I said, it's that easy? What's the next step? You've got to pull up those gold mines and put them in the middle of Lancashire, Yorkshire, right in the middle of London? You can't make country risk go away or change just because of where you're listed and traded. So the first case, we used revenue weights. Here we seem to be looking at production. Let me give you a third example, which kind of brings in shades of gray. You have an Indian automobile company with all of its plants in India, but gets 95% of its revenues in the US and 5% in India. Now what would you do? It's not quite like the software company, right? Where revenues are all I care about. It's not quite like the oil company because auto plants are kind of fixed, but they're more mobile than oil reserves. Could you wait using both revenues and where you get your production? Hey, you can do whatever you want in valuation as long as you can back it up. This is the nice thing about valuation. It's not accounting. You can't say, you can't do that. In this case, can you see that you might weigh both into the analysis? Some of you will be working with companies where revenue weights are all that matter. You know why with software companies, I'm so casual about where your software engineers are? If Israel goes to hell in a handbasket and you're worried, you can put those engineers on a couple of planes, get them somewhere else and say, go do your... It's moving your production is a lot easier when it's people in a building than when it's an auto plant, and definitely a lot easier than moving your oil reserves. The more flexibility you have in being able to move where you produce things, the less I care about production and the more I care about revenues. But it doesn't have to be 0-1. So what I'm laying the foundation for is I will do weights using revenues and production, but if you run into a company where you say, hey, what if both matter? Bring both in. You can factor both in. You have to decide how much each matters. And that's a judgment call. But it's not, doesn't have to be, you know, one is right and the other is wrong. It could be shades of gray. Any questions? Yes. No, the ERP should be based on the same currency. That's a troubling part because all my equity risk premiums are dollar equity risk premiums. So if you're doing your analysis in Egyptian pounds, you might say, well, is this going to create a problem for me? So it has nothing to do with country anymore. So each number carries its own weight, right? Your risk-free rate is your currency choice. Your beta reflects the businesses. I don't even care where the business is in. And when I talk about betas, you're going to see I don't run regressions against a local index, in which case you're doing all these gymnastics. Should I run the regression against the Sensex or the S&P 500 or the MSCI? I'm going to completely bypass that. And your equity risk premium carries the burden of where you do business. If your risk-free rate is in euros, my equity risk premiums are dollars. You're saying, can I use them? And I kind of indirectly answered that question last session when I said if your risk-free rates are roughly within the US dollar risk-free rate range, the premiums will carry because if your risk-free rate is 1%, 2%, so Australia, the UK, Euro, I have no qualms about using my risk premiums because the dollar number. But if you're in Zambia and your risk-free rate in the local currency is 15%, then you worry about carrying the dollar risk premiums because you're probably underestimating your risk premiums. There, the best thing to do is actually do everything in dollar terms and convert it into the... Remember the way we converted just the differential inflation? Do everything in dollar terms and convert it. So if you're worried about the mismatch in currencies, that's really the worry, then do everything in dollars and do that dollar conversion to make it into a different currency. Okay. Any other questions? Yes. No, actually, the problem is if all the expenses are in Nigerian naira. If they're in dollars, you have no problem, right? Because dollar. If you are in Nigerian naira expenses and your revenues are in dollars, which is a standard problem for any oil company, there's an exchange rate mismatch. It's not a risk premium issue. It's not a bait issue. It's not a risk-free issue. It could increase your default risk. You know what it's going to show up? Your cost of debt will be much higher because you've mismatched. You as a business might be much riskier because you've mismatched. And that mismatch, if it worries you from a valuation perspective and you run the company, you can eliminate. You've chosen to stay mismatched. So if you choose to stay mismatched, then I'm going to assess higher default risk and a lower value for your company because that mismatch could get you into trouble. So that's not an equity risk premium issue or even a beta issue. That's an issue of, hey, there are mismatched currencies in your operations. It could increase the riskiness of the default risk of your company because that's really where it's going to show up. Higher cost of debt and a higher cost of capital for the same level of debt. Okay. Yes?
When you're thinking of the risk, you're thinking of the non-diversifiable risk, right?
Right. You know, actually, I'm glad you brought it up. You know, McKinsey, our valuation books have kind of been in parallel for the last 30 years. The McKinsey valuation book, until the 1996 edition, said that companies, when they go globally, should use a cost of capital that's the same across countries. So if you're Coca-Cola, they said, if you have a 12% cost of capital in the U.S., and it's in dollar terms, you can take the 12% cost of capital to Russia, to Indonesia. And their argument was actually a diversification argument, which is if you're in 70 countries, things will happen in countries and things will average out. So why are we worrying about country risk? And in 86, they actually had a pretty good case for it. And here's how they backed it up. They showed the correlation across countries, right, in terms of, you know, if you look at it. And the correlation was very low. They said, there, that's why you should ignore country risk. And they sold us all on globalization, investors, companies. And as we all globalize, and you look at the correlation matrix as you go to the 90s, and especially as you go into the last decade, guess what's starting to happen in correlation across countries? It's starting to rise. So when Russia gets into trouble, and you're an oil company, guess what? Nigeria is getting into trouble at the same time. That's the covariance that's causing this country risk. Because you're right, we lived in a world where each country operated on almost its own economic calendar, its own. You wouldn't worry about country risk if you're a multinational. But unfortunately, that's not the world we live in, and that's why we're bringing country risk into our cost of equity and capital. Any other questions? So let's look at this process. So when you think about bringing your country risk into your cost of capital, generically, there are three ways you can do it. One is you can take risk-free rate plus beta times mature market premium, just like a CAPM, and add to it a country equity risk premium. That's a constant. What that'll do is every company will get a constant added on. The second approach, you take the risk-free rate plus beta, you move the country risk premium into the brackets, which means high beta companies will be more exposed to country risk than low beta companies. After all, beta measures exposure all of the macroeconomic risk, and we assume that macroeconomic risk and country risk go together. But that's asking for a lot. So the third approach is the most generic approach. You start with the risk-free rate, plus the question mark times the mature, don't ask me why Microsoft does this to me, but betas have become question marks. They'll also become bicycles in some of the pages, so wherever you see a bicycle or a question mark, think beta. You know, it's pretty much the same thing. Plus beta times mature market premium, so that's a CAPM. Plus country risk premium, I try to measure your exposure to country risk separately with a number that looks like a beta. I'll give you a little bit of history of this measure. It was in 2003, I was flying to Brazil to do a valuation seminar, and I was valuing two Brazilian companies, Ambev and Embraer. And at that time, I was doing what everybody did, which is treat them as Brazilian companies, slap this huge risk premium. In Brazil in 2003, the risk premium for the country was huge. So slapping this big risk premium, getting huge costs of equity, low values. And I was browsing through the annual report for Embraer. This is how I keep myself occupied on long flights. And there was a pie chart for Embraer's revenues in 2003. And in 2003, Embraer got 97% of its revenues in the US and Western Europe and 3% in Brazil. And I happened to have the Boeing annual report, don't ask me why. And I browsed through it, and there's a pie chart of Boeing's revenues, and I set the two pie charts next to each other, and I couldn't tell them apart. And here I was giving the U.S. equity risk premium to Boeing. Why? Because it was, at that time, Seattle-based and since moved to Chicago. And the Brazilian equity risk premium to Embraer because it was Brazil-based. And I was punishing both Ambev and Embraer, both Brazilian companies, exactly the same because they were Brazilian. Ambev at that time was almost entirely a Brazilian brewery. I mean, since then, it's kind of expanded the rest of Latin America. Almost 100% of its revenue is in Brazil. And I said, this doesn't make any sense. At least intuitively, I'd expect Embraer to be less exposed to Brazilian country risk than Embraer. We can talk about how to do it, but, you know. And I decided to concoct a measure. Notice the word I use, concoct. Derive means deep thinking went to it. Concoct means you make it up on a flight. You have nothing else to do. I concocted a measure. I decided to call it Lambda. Why? Because I've discovered attaching a Greek alphabet to anything you do adds a layer of sophistication that makes people a little more intimidated by it. I decided to call it Lambda. I didn't put my name ahead of it. No, I just called it Lambda. I landed in Brazil. I took that five-hour drive that it takes to get from Sao Paulo Airport to Sao Paulo. You could walk that distance most of the time faster than taking a car. I get in and I make this presentation and I throw this idea out. Don't you think? No, Embraer is less exposed. And everybody agrees. And I said, I think we do this Lambda measure. And then one of the more practical people in the audience raises his hand and asks the question, how do you plan to measure Lambda? And I said, I haven't thought about that yet, but I have a long flight back, and I will think about it then. In fact, on that flight back, I wrote a paper that's now on my website called Estimating Company Risk Exposure to Country Risk. It's about what I would need to estimate Lambdas, and I started off with an inventory of all the things I'd like to know about a company to know how exposed it was to country risk. Like, where are your factories? Where do you get your revenues? Does the government really view you as a key company for the country? That's always a deadly sign for country risk, is if you're viewed as somebody that because then the government feels the urge to step in. So I made a list, and then I thought about which of these items would I actually be able to get data on as an investor in a company. And the reality is, in most companies, the only item that is consistently broken down by country is revenue. Everything else is a crapshoot. Some companies will tell you, I mean, take a look at Microsoft's annual report, right? The revenue is broken down geographically. I would love to know how much of Microsoft software is written in Bangalore and how much is written in Seattle. But they don't break down, and they're not alone. But if they did that, I said, I'd like to know that. And then I came up with different ways of estimating risk premium. And it was a pushback against this notion of, you tell me where you're incorporated, and I'll tell you what the risk premium is, the old way. Saying, look, that's not how investors should think about risk. It should come from where you do business. Whether you measure the revenues or production, we can argue, but it's where you do where your operations are that drive your risk premium. So let's think about the simplest way of measuring exposure. As I said, revenues are the one item that companies consistently break down. So here I've taken two examples. Here's Embraer and Ambev. And Embraer in 2004, if you look at its breakdown, got 97% of its revenues from US and Western Europe, 3% from Brazil. And if I base my equity risk premium entirely on revenues, it looks like a US company. And I'll be quite honest, I'm probably underestimating Embraer's equity risk premium by doing this. Why? Because all of their production is still in Brazil. So I'm ignoring production entirely, but if I ignore production entirely, it looks very much like a US company. With Ambev, when I break down their revenues, or they break down their revenues, most of the time I am dependent on the company breaking these down. Their breakdown of revenues, and this was in 2011, they were about 64% in Brazil in 2011. The rest comes from the rest of Latin America, and where you get revenues in Latin America can make a big difference in what your equity risk premium is, because there is a big difference between operating in Chile and operating in Argentina. Okay? So that weighted out. Again, I'm using revenue weights. Partly because of desperation, because that's all I can get, and partly because it's convenient. I think I'm on safer ground using revenue weights for Ambev than for Embraer, because the production costs in beverages is a very small percent of total cost. Most of the costs are SG&A on top of, but you can see in both cases I'm focusing on revenue weights. The danger with revenue weights is you are stuck with looking just at revenues. And finally, if I take Coca-Cola and look at their revenues, it's a US company, at least on the face of it. It's Atlanta-based, but its revenues come from the rest of the world. Okay. You're saying, why are you breaking down by region, not by country? First, I don't want 74 line items on my spreadsheet. Second, Coca-Cola actually breaks their revenues down by region. They don't break it down by country. And if you go back a couple of pages to the country risk premiums, you'll notice that there's an equity risk premium by region. Those are the weighted average risk premiums of the equity risk premiums in the countries in those regions, weighted by GDP. And the reason I compute that is precisely because there are companies like Coca-Cola where they said, we get 31% of our revenues in Asia. They don't tell you where. I am going to assume that if it's coming from Asia, a big chunk of it is coming from India and China and the bigger economy, smaller pieces from Vietnam. I could be completely wrong, but it's not my fault. I mean, they don't break it down. I'm kind of stuck with whatever the breakdown is. There's my weighted average. Live in the world you're in, not the world you wished you were in. So when you sit down to value a company and you look for this in your company, prepare to get frustrated. Because companies do terrible things in how they break their revenues down. I mean, U.S. companies are among the worst culprits. You know what a typical U.S. company's breakdown of revenues would look like? 72% of our revenues come from the U.S. 28% come from the rest of the world. Come on, guys. The rest of the world is a really big place. Can we start to get specific? This is what frustrates me about accounting rule writers. They write all these rules on disclosures and things I don't even care about. And on items like revenue breakdown, they let companies skate by with the rest of the world. You're saying, what do I do? Well, live in the world you're in. The rest of the world has an equity risk premium. All you need to do is take my equity risk premium by country, make the GDP for the US zero, and you compute your weighted average. You have a weighted average for the rest of the world. So that's why I actually report. So if you go to the spreadsheet, I give you GDP by country and the equity risk premium by country. You can compute weighted averages for any subset of the world you want to get. I just attach. I think the equity risk premium for the rest of the world right now, for the US was 5.2%. For the rest of the world was 6.28%. So if I ever run into a company like that, I give 5.2% for the US, 6.28% for the rest of the world, and I'm moving on. Because to sit there and wring my hands saying, I wish I knew more, is not going to change the facts. So by focusing on revenues, there are dangers, as in the case of Embraer, that you're missing other aspects of risk, right? And it's not something you can bring into your beta. This is not the kind of risk that you can bring into your beta. So here's what I would suggest as an alternative if you have companies like oil companies. You know, 2015 was valuing Royal Dutch. Okay? Extraordinarily boring company to value. But somebody's got to do the dirty work, I guess. To get the equity risk premium for Royal Dutch, I'd look at where the revenues are. Frankly, I don't care. I looked at where they get their oil, and guess what? They get it from the riskiest parts of the world. Why? Because I think this is the mixed blessing of having oil. God gives you oil and then says, you're now a risky country. Because it's almost like the two go together. You don't get a lot of oil in safe countries. Maybe Norway was the exception, but they very quickly slipped through the net and got back to being a non-oil producing company or a low oil producing company. But if you look at oil companies, their risk comes from the fact that their oil comes from the riskiest part. And they do break down their production. That's one nice thing about oil companies. Is you look at their annual reports or their 10Ks, you will see a breakdown of where the production comes from. So my equity risk premium for Royal Dutch in 2015 was 8.26%. That is higher than the equity risk premiums I estimated for most emerging market companies in 2015. Royal Dutch might delude itself into thinking it's either Dutch or British, depending on which day of the week you're looking at it. But it's neither. It's an emerging market company that through the accident of history happens to be incorporated and traded in these two developed markets. Oil companies, for the most part, are emerging or look like emerging market companies when it comes to equity risk premiums. Which brings me to this lambda question. So when I sat down and said, hey, you know, what should I look? I looked at revenues, I looked at production. I also would love to know what risk management products you've used as a company. Maybe you have insurance against some of these risks. Maybe you have derivatives, okay? And if you can report it, that'll help me. It'll also help me to know if your company is viewed as a company in the national interest. That's not a good sign if you're thinking about Lambda, because if you're viewed in the national interest, it almost always comes with extra country risk. So often natural resource companies are viewed as companies in the national interest. You can't let them go, okay? And that then plays out as a higher Lambda. So the question is, how do we bring all of this information into a Lambda? Again, I'm going to start simple with the one number we get for every company, which is revenues. And if you want to think about estimating lambdas purely upon revenues, here's how it's going to play out. Let's say your company, in this case, let me take two companies in India, Tata Motors and TCS, both part of the Tata Group. And in 2008, 2009, Tata Motors got about 91% of its revenues in India. And Tata Consulting Services got less than 8% of its revenues in India. Both Indian companies, very different Indian exposure. Here's how I get a lambda. I take the 91% that Tata Motors gets from India and divide it by what the average Indian company gets as revenues in India. This can be a pain in the neck in some countries to estimate. In the US, it's actually pretty easy because the S&P reports what percentage of revenues of the S&P 500 companies come from the US and elsewhere. But in other countries, you actually have to kind of build up to it from the bottom up. In fact, if you have access to a Bloomberg, you can build up to the data is there. That number was 80%. 91 divided by 80 would give me a lambda of 1.14 for Tata Motors. 7.62 divided by 80 would give me a lambda of 0.09. That would then become the lambda I multiply by the Indian country risk premium. So this is with the third approach, risk-free rate plus beta times mature market premium plus lambda times country risk. But it's built entirely on revenues. What I'm trying to do is, essentially with this approach, say some companies are more exposed. So lambda becomes a measure of how exposed is my company to country risk relative to the average company in the country. So if you produce exactly 80% of your revenues in India, I treat you as having a lambda of 1 as exposed to the typical company. Well below 80, no, less exposed. Over 80, more exposed. Okay. And if you want to get fancy, there's a way in which you can estimate lambdas, which the numbers are extraordinarily noisy. But it's an interesting way to start to think about country risk. You know how we estimate betas, right? To estimate a beta, we take returns in the stock, regress it against returns in the market index. The slope of the line is the beta because it tells you, as the market changes, how does my stock change? How is it affected? What am I trying to measure with a lambda? How exposed is my company to country risk, right? So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take returns in the stock. In this case, I took Embraer and Embratel, two Brazilian companies, and regressed it not against returns on a market index, but returns on a C bond, which is a dollar-denominated Brazilian bond. And here's what I was trying to capture. When you have big shifts in country risk, the place it plays out is in that bond. So if your risk jumps, the price of your bond will decrease. So essentially, it becomes a proxy for country risk. The slope of the line I get is essentially a lambda estimated the same way I got betas. So in the case of Embraer, for instance, that slope was 0.27. To the degree that I trust this regression, I'll explain why I use those words, the lambda for Embraer is 0.27. The lambda for Embratel, which is entirely focused on Brazil, can't go anywhere else, is actually it's a little bit higher than 2. It's every 1% shock to the country translates to almost twice the impact on the country. So if you use the lambda approach, you could use 0.27 as the lambda for Embraer and 2 as the lambda. I'll tell you why I'm a little wary of this. In a little while, we're going to talk about betas and we're going to talk about standard errors. You're saying this isn't a statistics class. Everything is a statistics class because you work with data. You can't run away from statistics. These are lambdas I get as slopes, but these slopes have standard errors. And the standard errors are pretty large. So the 0.27 looks precise until I tell you that the standard error is 0.15 on it. The 2 looks precise, and the standard error is 0.23. So I almost never use this approach to, unless I have a company that's so focused on one country that I want to really estimate the lambda. But the data is starting to come in, and you know what we can use instead of dollar? I gave away the answer. And so the dollar bond is now we can use sovereign CDS spreads. Because those changes in spreads across time become a measure of country risk, you can see how your company responds as people get more or less, optimistic about your company, about your country's risk profile going forward. So just to show you how different the numbers are going to be depending on how you slice and dice the data, here's what I did. I took Embraer in September of 2004 and estimated 5 different costs of equity. All in dollar terms, so the risk-free rate is the same in all of them. 4% was the risk-free rate then. The beta is the same in all of them. And I'll talk a little bit about how I got the beta. It's 1.07. But here's the difference. The first approach, I multiplied the beta by the equity risk premium for the US, at that time 5%, mature market premium, and added to that the entire country risk premium for Brazil, which was 7.89% then, to come up with the cost of equity. Approach two, I did the same thing I did in approach one, But then I did a revenue-weighted country risk premium, 3% from Brazil, 97%. Bottom line is, wherever I bring in the fact that their revenues come primarily from outside Brazil, I get a much lower cost of equity, 11 to 12%. In fact, I get actually less than 10% if I do country. And wherever I focus on them as a Brazilian company, I get 17 to 18%. So basically, I have two very different numbers. If I treat them as a Brazilian company, I get 17 to 18% cost of equity. If I treat them as a company that is Brazil-based but gets much of its revenues outside, I get much lower cost of equity. You're saying, so what? Let's assume that everybody does what the conventional practice is now, which is treat it as a Brazilian company, give it a really high cost of equity, valued on that basis. And you come into the picture and say, that doesn't make sense. And you're talking logically. You're saying, well, we should use a much lower cost of equity. So you're going to come up with a value for Embraer, which is different from the analyst. So my question is, let's say all emerging market companies are valued based on where they're incorporated, but you believe that they should be doing it right, that you should look at where their revenues come from. You have a different cost of equity. I'm going to give you two choices. No, I think the answer is pretty obvious, but I want you to work it out. If you do this, will emerging market companies with substantial exposure and developed market companies, will they be significantly overvalued or undervalued by analysts? What's going to happen? If analysts are just applying a risk premium based on where you're incorporated, will emerging market companies like Embraer, like TCS, be overvalued or undervalued? You're going to come up with too low a value, right? Because as an analyst, and you're coming along, you're going to come up with a higher value. Let's say you have faith. You know why faith comes in here, right? You go buy the stock at its prevailing low value. Then what are you going to do? You're going to try to talk people into doing the right thing. I'll save you the trouble. It's a waste of time. You can talk to people, but they're going to do what they're going to do. But is there... What's a catalyst? I mean, obviously, something has to happen for this to correct itself, right? What's a catalyst that'll cause analysts to say, oh, I should never have done that. Embraer is a Brazil-based company, but it's really not affected by country risk. A catastrophe might be one thing. It could also be a series of earnings reports that come in solid, even when the country is going to hell in a handbasket. The true answer is there is no clean catalyst. So you could be right, and you could go bankrupt being right. I have faith. I believe eventually the truth will win out. I might be. So here's what I do. I take every emerging market and I find companies like Embraer and TCS in every market. And there are at least three or four companies in every emerging market which are in that market but get a bulk, the Vinamilk in Vietnam. You know, this is a dairy company, extraordinarily well run. Vietnamese company gets about 75% of its revenues outside Vietnam, in Australia, New Zealand. You know. So I take a list of those companies. And then I sit and wait. Wait for what? I wait for a crisis in that market. You're saying, what if there's no crisis? Are you kidding me? It's an emerging market. There will be a crisis. It's not a question of whether. It's a question of when. And in a crisis, what happens? People panic. When they panic, what do? Especially if you have foreign institutional investors, they all sell and run at the same time. And they sell everything. I wait for a crisis, and I go to my list and say, okay, is this the time? About, I would say there are at least seven or eight. I bought Embraer at the time Lula was running for president. This was way back in time, and people were freaking out. He's a communist, the whole thing. They're going to nationalize it, sell everything, get out of here now, you know. And I bought Embraer then. It's still in my portfolio. But it's, you're looking for that, and that's why we do intrinsic valuation. Because some of the things we do, you're saying, but that's not the way analysts do it. And I agree, they might get betas from Bloomberg and equity risk premium based on the country they're in, and everybody might be doing it, but there's a truth here you're trying to find with intrinsic value. I mean, it takes ego to assume you found the truth. But the faith here is eventually value will come out. And if you don't have that faith, that's okay too. But then don't invest based on value, invest based on price. Trade. Right? The essence of investing is you believe there's a better way, I wouldn't say the right way, a better way of doing these things, and eventually the price will reflect that value. So when you get a chance, pick a couple of emerging markets, start looking for companies. It's not difficult to find them. Okay? Make a list. Don't do anything right now, because as I said, you've got to be have enough faith to be able to pull the trigger. And then watch those markets. Looking for a chance, we said, now's the price at which I'm going to buy, because I'm really buying a U.S. company in terms of revenues and volatility and risk that happens to be incorporated and trade in Vietnam or Indonesia or India, and hoping that that stability eventually shows up. Yes?
So what's preventing a private equity firm from purchasing an emerging market company with revenues in the U.S.? And then
you're assuming private equity investors have long time horizons. I don't. Now, some of them might, but most private equity investors, there's neither private nor equity about them. They're just investors who like to slap the name private equity and act, you know, because it gives them that patina of, I'm in here for the long term, I want to change the company. There are a few private equity players who do that, right? They buy the company, they buy the cash flows and say, hey, you guys might think whatever you think, but we think the... they're very limited. Most private equity investors I've discovered are just mutual funds disguised as private equity funds. They do what mutual funds do, which is they ride the momentum game. So if you're a true private equity investor, this is a chance you have. But you have to be big enough, right? An Embraer is not something that a small private equity fund. So you have to, if you're a big enough private equity fund, in fact, it's one way in which you can create value is to go to markets in Asia and Latin America where you have companies like these, buy the entire company, because then you don't need the catalyst. You just collect the cash flows. And so it is done by some of them, okay? But it's not arbitrage, right? There's nothing guaranteed even when you do it. You still have to wait for the cash flows to come in. And guess what? Your investors might not see that gratification you get when the price jumps up because you're collecting the cash flows. Trust us, we're getting the cash flows from it. Okay? So it's not that it's not done, but it's not done enough for it to go away because it's still risky and it still requires a time horizon where all you care about is the cash flows. Most private equity funds want to flip the company back to public and make the money from the price appreciation. No, very few private equity funds just say, look, I'll collect the cash flows for the rest of eternity. They need to cash out. And for that cashing out, you still need a catalyst to take the market, you know, the company back to the market. Maybe they can relist it in a different market and get past that local country list. But it's something to think about. There are no guarantees here. There is an opportunity, but it's not necessarily a risk-free opportunity. Any other questions? Now let's talk about equity risk premiums. I mean, as I said, when I talked about historical equity risk premiums, you know, you're looking backwards, the number is noisy. I can't believe that we build these entire valuations around that number. So I gave you the alternative of let's look forward. And I gave you that very simplistic example of you tell me what you pay for stocks, I can back out from what you pay what the premium is. I'm going to bring that into equities. And I'm saying, look, if I know what an index is trading at, and I can estimate the expected cash flows, and that's all I can do is estimate the expected cash flows, I can back out from the price of the index what the internal rate of return is. And once I do that, I can back out an equity risk premium. So rather than talk in abstractions, let me take you back to the start of 2008. There's a reason I want to go back that far. This was the year of the crisis, but it was the start of the year. The S&P 500 was trading at 1,468.36. That's what people were paying for the index. And at that time, if you looked at the cash flows came from dividends and buybacks because the U.S. stocks, you know, big chunk came from buybacks. I projected out what the expected cash flows would be given what the cash flows were last year, the previous year, because that's all I knew, and an expected growth rate. And here I had to trust analysts. You're saying, isn't that dangerous? If I were doing an entire valuation, it might be, but here I'm trying to back out what the premium is, and I have to build in what market expectations are. So I put in that growth rate. So here's what I have. I know what you paid. I have expected cash flows for the next 5 years. At the end of the fifth year, I stop, but I can't just give up after year five because stocks keep going. So after year five, here's what I assumed. I assumed that the cash flows would continue to grow, and I'm oddly precise about how fast they would grow, 4.02%. It sounds like I have a crystal ball, but I don't. You know what I'm using is my growth rate in perpetuity. I'm setting it equal to my risk-free rate, saying over the long term, my risk-free rate is a pretty good proxy for my nominal growth. So I have expected cash. If this looks even remotely familiar, it's because you've used it to compute the yield to maturity on a bond. We do this all the time with bonds, right? Price of the bond, coupons, face value. The yield to maturity is that discount rate that makes the present value of your cash flows. I'm doing the same thing. I'm taking the level of the index, solving for the internal rate of return, And the number I get is 8.39%. You say, what does that even tell me? At the start of 2008, if you bought U.S. stocks, I don't care what you hoped you would make, what you prayed you would make, what you told me you wanted to make, given what you were paying for those stocks, you can make 8.39%. The risk-free rate is 4.02%, the T-bond rate. The difference becomes my implied equity risk premium. Yes?
In a way, are you biased towards dividend or stock buyback-based companies? So the risk premium doesn't reflect what is happening with other companies that are not as...
Well, if I did this for the S&P 600, I'd have much lower cash flows. Not because they don't want to buy back stock, but they don't have the cash to buy back stock. But you know what I would have to compensate? Because I've done this for the S&P 600. I get much higher growth rates. So it is true if I switch to a different index where I have less cash flows. Many emerging markets, the cash flows will be low, but the growth will be higher. What will kill you is if you have a market where the cash flows are low and the growth will be low. But what's killing you is not the approach, but the fact that these are terrible stocks, right? So it is true. What would the reason I have to include buybacks, if I count just dividends and I don't count the buybacks and I keep the growth low, then I'm not quite being fair about the returns either. So I have to bring in the buybacks and I'm solving for that expected return. That then becomes the basis for my... So at the start of 2008, your implied equity risk premium is 4.37%. I don't know about you. Start of 2008, I didn't see the crisis coming down the pike. I know people claim they saw it coming. Everybody seems to have seen it coming. I must have been the only person who did not. So if I bought stocks, I said, you know what? This is what the premium is. And I'm not a market timer. I've always said, look, an investment. And of course, you know, by the end of the year, things had changed pretty dramatically. That was the year of the crisis. Between September and December, stocks collapsed. So the end of 2008, when I redid this, the start of 2009, the index was, at the start of 2009, was 903.25. Do you remember what it was a year prior? 1,468.36, right? It's down to 903. That's what the crisis did. It melted down. The crisis did affect my cash flows. Buybacks got cut back in the last quarter, so dividends and buybacks came in. So the index is down, cash flows are down, and growth rates are now dampened because people worry about, you know, there could be a recession. So everything's kind of changed. I redid the calculation with the new level of the index, new lower cash flows, and a new, much lower T-bond rate. The same crisis that's causing the market to collapse, bringing down growth rates, is also bringing down T-bond rates because people are less optimistic about the future. I saw for the required return. The return actually didn't change by that much. Remember, it was 8.39% a year ago? It's now jumped to 8.64%. But the big shift is the risk-free rate, which was 4.02%, has now dropped to 2.21%. And the equity risk premium, which was 4.37%, has now become 6.43%. That's the biggest one-year change in equity risk premiums in U.S. equity market history, at least because I've been been calculating this, I would say, since 1960, but that would make me a prodigy. You know, I had to put numbers back and kind of work backwards in time. This is the biggest change in a single year that has ever occurred in U.S. equity markets. In fact, this wasn't supposed to. In a developed market, things like this never happen. That's what made the 2008 crisis so scary, is this was not supposed to happen in a developed market. But it did. In fact, if you focus just on those last 12 weeks of 2008, starting September 12th, which is the day before the Lehman collapse, the weekend that Lehman collapsed, all the way through December 31st, I computed the implied equity risk premium every day on my way to work. It's kind of self-torture. And, but it, I did it basically to calm myself down, because if you were just listening to the news or reading the papers, you would freak out. This is my, you know, my Valium. In investing, I'm not suggesting any addictions to you. This is my investing, calm down. You know, and because in the middle of a crisis, you got to kind of step back and say, let's look at what's happening. And in this case, you could see, as you go through the equity risk premium, it started, so the green is the equity risk premium, the red is the index. As the index drops, the equity risk premium climbs. There was a day in November where the implied equity risk premium in the U.S. hit 8%, almost double from the start of the year. Until 2008, I used to compute the equity risk premium for the U.S. at the start of every year and use it for the whole year. And if somebody pushed me, I'd said, It's a developed market. How much can happen in a year? And this graph kind of answered how much can happen in a year. So since September of 2008, I've been doing the equity risk premium for the S&P 500 every month. So if you visit my website, you'll see it right on that front page. Equity risk premium as of February 1st, 2020 is. And every company I value in February, I use that number. It's 5.24%. What will it be in March? I've got to wait till March to find out. In January, it was 5.2%. The reason I do that is there will be crisis months where the number can move pretty dramatically. In fact, every time there's been a crisis month in the last 12 years, I've started doing it by day during that month, now, whatever the crisis, because it gives me a sense of how much should I be panicking. It's actually a very interesting way to also answer a different question. I mean, right now, is a stock of a bubble? Are stocks in a bubble, right? Let me give you at least a tool that you can use to discuss this. I'm not going to tell you whether they're in a bubble or not, because that's not my job. I shouldn't be giving you market timing advice. But I'll give you a structure to think through this question. I started 2020. The S&P 500 was 3,230.78. If you'd bought stocks at the start of 2009, remember index was at 900? You wouldn't have to do a thing. You'd have triple your money, everything. So sometimes getting in at the right time and getting out at the right time can be critical. That's why people try to time markets. 3,230.78. The cash flows in the 12 months leading into 2020, the cash flows were 150.5. And you can see how much the balance in the U.S. has shifted away from dividends to stock buybacks. 63% of the cash flows in 2019, the trailing 12 months, came from buybacks, 37% from dividends, 150.50. Analysts were projecting a growth of 3.96%. The growth rate I use is called a top-down growth rate. You're saying, what does that even mean? There are two ways you can estimate growth for the S&P 500. One is to take each company, look up what analysts are projecting for that company, and take it across all companies. That growth rate tends to be too high. Analysts, when they do bottom-up estimates, tend to overestimate growth, partly because they act like the rest of the world doesn't even exist. They take their company, they have all these great dreams, they build it in, they don't factor in what happens to the rest of the companies. Top-down forecasts come from people who track the earnings for the entire index. They tend to be wrong, but they're not biased. Sometimes they overshoot, sometimes they undershoot. Their projected growth rate at the start of 2020 was 3.96%. So here's what I did. I took the 150.50, grew it at 3.96% for the next 5 years, and beyond the fifth year, grew it at the risk-free rate. I'm doing exactly the same thing I did in 2008 and 2009. And the expected return I got for stocks was 7.12%. Well below the 8.64% at the start of 2009. But if I subtract out the T-bond rate, 1.92%, my equity risk premium at the start of 2020 was 5.20%. That's a number that became 5.24% at the start of February. And will probably go down in March, given what markets have done this month. But basically, that is my implied premium at the start of January. So here's the mechanism you can use to decide whether markets are too high, too low. And as I said, the final call is yours. Take a look at that equity risk premium. So let me ask you a generic question. If you're investing in equities, are you okay with that 5.2%? Is it too low? Is it too high? How many of you feel that it's too low given how risky equities are? Nobody? Okay. That means there isn't a single person in this room who buys into the notion that stocks are overvalued. Because it's exactly the same thing, right? Because if you tell me the equity risk premium is too low, you're saying stocks are overvalued. If you tell me the equity risk premium looks too high, you're telling me stocks are undervalued. It wasn't a fair question because how do I know 5.2%? Is it high? Is it low? Let me give you some history. This is what implied equity risk premiums have looked like for U.S. equities going back to 1960. The average across those 60 years that I have these implied premiums, so basically I'm doing the implied premium at the start of every year, was 4.20%. So relative to that, the premium is much higher. But you could say those are old times, it's pre-2008. Relative to just the last 10 years, it's a little lower, but not by much. There are a lot of people out there making arguments that stocks are in a bubble. They might be completely right in their judgment, but the arguments are extraordinarily lazy. Because here's the basis for their argument. You know what the basis is? We've had 10 good years, so stocks must be in a bubble. Let's take that statement apart. Have we had 10 good years? Yes. Stocks are up about 300% over the last, if you take the total return. It's been 10 good years. Does that mean we're in a bubble? Well, I don't see how you can jump from the first to the second that easily, because you got to tell me more. You, of course, hear about P/E ratios being high. We're going to come back and re-examine that question, because that question is also based on, you know, kind of a foundation of sand. But to me, this becomes a core number that I would use to challenge anybody who says, if you tell me you're in a bubble, then tell me what's going to change. And I'll play devil's advocate. If you want me to make a bubble story, take a look at this number. What's the weakest link in this number? What's causing the equity risk premiums now to look? It's a low risk-free rate, right? I mean, if we had risk-free rates like we did in 2008, which was 4%, my equity risk... So here's one story, that risk-free rates will climb. This is the central banking conspiracy theory, which is the central bank stopped conspiring to keep rates low. We're all doomed. And for 8 years, I've heard this story from multiple places. I've unfortunately gotten this email list of this guy called John Hussman. If you ever get a chance, visit his site. He's been telling me for 8 years to stay out of stocks, stay out of stocks, stay out of stocks. I call these the Eeyores of the market. Have you ever watched Winnie the Pooh? You get, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. At one point, the sky might eventually fall, but think of all the good days you've lost waiting for the sky to fall. So one argument is... interest rates are going to climb, but the reason that argument is so tough to sustain is the kind of conditions that will cause rates to rise will include things like the economy is doing much better than expected, in which case, what else is going to change? My growth rates are going to be higher, my cash flows are going to be higher. It's very difficult to tell a story where everything else stays fixed and my rates jump from 1.92 to 4. But maybe it's all central banking set, and maybe that's one potential. The second is, why are my returns so high? It's not because companies are paying big dividends, it's because they're buying back a lot of stock. So the second story is, this too shall end. You're going to run out of cash. Okay. In which case, you have to back it up by showing me you're running out of cash. So a little later in this class, I'll show you cash balances at US companies. And there's actually no sign that you're running out of cash, but the kinds of stories you need to tell for markets to fall apart at least are not obvious to me. Could I conceive some really convoluted story where market... Yes, but I'm not even hearing those convoluted stories. I'm just saying, trust me, markets are in a bubble. Trust me, markets are going to fall. And the numbers don't seem to back it up. And that's part of the reason I do the monthly equity risk premium, is to get a sense of, should I be starting to get worried? That's why on March 15th, I'm going to be watching the S&P 500 buyback numbers. The updates come once every 3 months. Is there a big drop-off in buybacks? Those will be red flags that make me worry about the market being overvalued. But ex ante, if you're just looking at the market, I can't pass that judgment. Very little. I'll tell you what's keeping the risk premiums high is if you just take the 150.50, divide by the level of the index now, you get almost 4.8%. That's the bulk of the premium. The growth is getting from 4.8 to 5.2%. So that's why my worry is not that growth will collapse, but that the cash flows will implode, because growth could go to 0%, my equity risk will still be 4.8%. So that's why I don't worry that much about my growth being off. It's really the cash flows and the low risk-free rate that are keeping this afloat. So one of the questions, of course, that you ask is, and this is actually a weekly chance for this week, is I'm going to give you my entire 60-year history of implied equity risk premiums, and I'm going to show you the risk-free rates. And the old story, at least until about a decade ago, is when rates are high, risk premiums should be high. When rates drop off, premiums should come down. Why? Because if your T-bond rate is 10%, you probably will demand a higher risk premium on top of that than if they're 2%. So if you look at the 1970s, for instance, when the equity risk premiums rose, the reason was simple. T-bond rates were rising, inflation was high. But that relationship has progressively started to break down. It's completely broken down the last decade. Because if that history were true, at a 1.92% risk-free rate, my equity risk premium should be much lower than 5.2%. I shouldn't be demanding this larger premium. So at least in the US, there seems to be almost no link between the level of risk-free rates and the risk premium, which is actually nice news because it means you can take an equity risk premium, you compute on a 1.92% and use it on a 4% risk-free rate. And it's still going to be okay. And that was why I said if your risk-free rate is within, you know, shouting distance of a US risk-free rate, I have no qualms about adding that risk premium on top. Of course, if your T-bond rate goes to 10, 12, 14%, then we have to re-examine the question. But at least based on history, there seems to be no link between equity risk premiums and what the level of the risk-free rate is. So this is all equity-focused, right? But there are whole other markets out there. There's the bond market. Think of the equity risk premium as the price of risk in the equity market. That's what investors are demanding. Is there an equivalent price of risk in the bond market? Or what is that equivalent price of risk? So equity risk premium is what you're charging for taking risk in the equity market. If you're investing in the corporate bond market, it's default spreads, right? And those numbers are actually easier to kind of track over time because they're observable. It's a difference between what you pay on a triple B rated bond and a risk-free rate. So I decided to put both the numbers on the same graph. So I know this is an incredibly messy graph to look at. The blue line is my equity risk premium. The brown line is actually the spread on a BAA rated bond, an investment grade bond over time. So let's start with what I think is the big news. The two tend to move together most of the time. And that shouldn't surprise you. The same investors are getting panicked in one market are probably getting panicked in the other. But there have been two periods in the last 25 years where the two have moved in different directions. And they both have been potentially catastrophic. The first is in the 1990s. If you look in the 1990s, the equity risk premium drops and drops and drops and keeps dropping. That's the dot-com boom. The BAA default spread actually stays pretty stable and actually climbs. So in 1999, the equity risk premium was down to 2%. So in 1999, if you made a case of stocks are in a bubble, you had a much better case to make, 2% way too low. A BAA default spread was also about 2%. I was giving you a chance to buy an investment-grade bond, and you were getting the same spread on that bond as you were getting on equities collectively. I know it's very difficult to step away and be objective in hindsight. But at the end of 99, if you just looked at those two numbers as an investor, where would you rather have your money? In stocks or bonds? Bonds. It's easy to say now, but at the end of 99, you were too afraid of being left behind by not being in equities. So people are still investing in equities. But if you're a corporate finance treasurer or a CFO trying to say, where should I raise money? At the end of 99, the equity markets are charging you almost nothing for risk. The bond markets are still charging you a hefty spread. Would you rather raise equity or would you rather raise debt as a company in 99? I would raise equity till the cows come home. Why? Because equity is being basically you're being priced to deliver very low risk premium. So the first phase of this mismatch was in the late 90s. And of course, the numbers adjusted back in a couple of years. You had the correction for the dot-com boom, risk premiums bopped up in the equity market. And for a brief period, we had some steady state. Then you got to 2003. And Alan Greenspan, in a moment of the ego of central banks, said, I will not let the US economy go into recession. And for the next 4 years, the Fed played games in the bond market. And in the process, push spreads down across almost every bond rating class. So if you look at the default spreads between 2002 and 2006, you can see default spreads start to drop, but equity risk premiums stay high. So this is the flip side of 99. Bond spreads are coming down, equity. And that, of course, laid the foundations for the 2008 crisis. Now, if you ask where did the 2008 crisis come from, each of us will have a different answer. If you saw The Big Short, it's all the housing, it's financial service firms. Fundamentally, the 2008 crisis came not because people were lending to people with high credit risk, but they were lending to people with high credit risk and not charging enough of a spread to cover that credit risk. Remember, through history, there have all been good businesses lending to people with high credit risk and charging a high enough interest rate. The spreads had become too low. And of course, you see the correction. That's 2008. You can see default spreads shoot up. You know, equity risk premium shoot up. You have corrections basically back to what should be. And since 2008, you've started to see bond spreads and equity risk premiums start to move together a lot more. But this graph tells me that I need to keep my eye on both those numbers, because when they start to diverge, at least historically, bad things tend to happen if the divergence continues for a long enough time period. One of the problems we all will face is we're going to end up in one of these markets or the other. You're going to either end up in equities, you're going to end up in bonds, and never the twain shall meet. You'll talk to just equities people, and you'll forget that there's an entire bond market out there. The bond people talk to other bond people, they forget the equity market is out there. There's almost no interplay here where people say, what's your equity, what's our price? There should be some process by which you compare the price of risk. And this is where the macro hedge funds that do this right have stepped into the breach, because they say, we can track different markets, and when they start to diverge, we can try to take advantage of them. So that's stock market, bond market. Let me bring one final market into the picture. Yes. If you want, you can bring it and ask the same question. Because with equity risk premiums, there was almost no relationship between the T-bond rate and the equity risk premium. You can take the default spread and see if that is related to the T-bond rate. In fact, the weekly challenge this week, I give you the equity risk premium every year. I'll give you the T-bond rate every year. I give you the BAA default spread every year. It's just a correlation number. It basically computed because, you know, it is an empirical question. Theoretically, I can give you all kinds of stories about what should happen, but what actually happens is in the numbers. I'm going to bring one final market into this picture. So this is equity versus bond, the price of risk. This is a big real estate market out there, right? And real estate is the most underserved and under-researched market of the three because much of it is not public. So you look at research, you look at analysis, almost always the real estate market stays out of the fray. But in the real estate market, there are people who invest in real estate, developers, they make judgments based on what properties to buy or how to price them. And there is actually a price of risk in the real estate market as well, and it is observable as well. How many of you worked in real estate at some point in time? Are you familiar with cap rates? Can you tell me what a cap rate is? Okay, so let's take a number. Let's say your cap rate is 8% and I have rental income of $1 million on a property. How would that play out? I take the million, 8% cap rate. I would pay 1.25 million. Or basically, I would capitalize the income. It would be 12.5 million, right, to get the 8% income. A cap rate is really a real estate developer's cost of equity for investing in a property. You see where I'm going to go next? If I know what the cap rate is and I know what the risk-free rate is, taking the difference between those two numbers should give me a risk premium for the real estate market. So what I did was I went and collected cap rates every year going back. And there's a national cap. I don't know how reliable this number is because it varies by region and by type of property. And I put that into the graph as well. Now we're getting really messy. So basically what you see in the blue is the equity risk premium. The red is the bond default spread. That's from the previous graph. The two kind of move together most of the time. See this number? This is my cap rate minus my risk-free rate. Think of it as my real estate risk premium. And at first sight, it looks very strange, at least in the 1980s. Why does it look strange? It's negative. You're saying, why would I accept less than the risk-free rate for investing in a risky asset? When I did my MBA, I was told as an investor, the best thing to do is if you have a lot of financial assets, you should hold real estate. And what's the rationale for holding real estate? What were you told the benefits were? They tended to move in opposite directions. You got a diversification benefit. You actually made your overall portfolio less risky. And after the 70s, people were willing to listen, right? Because in the 70s, one of the few real estate classes that held up in value was, the few asset classes that held up in value was real estate. So people say, oh, you know what, you're right. And if you believe that real estate is actually a risk dampener, it reduces the risk, when you invest in real estate, it's like buying a negative beta investment. Essentially you're saying, you know what, I'll settle for less than the risk-free rate because much of my money is invested in financial assets. Real estate makes my portfolio less risky. So that's the 1980s. Then you get to the 90s, notice something happening to the real estate risk premium. it's starting to behave more and more like the stock and the bond premium. The three are starting to move together. I have two questions. First, why do you think that started happening in the 90s? Because it's now clearly set into place that real estate equity risk premiums are now moving like equity and bond premiums. What do you think caused the three to start to move together? REITs were 70s. So REITs actually have always been around, but they were a very tiny part of real estate. But in the 80s and the 90s, you started to see the rest of real estate get securitized, mortgage-backed securities. So essentially, as you see real estate getting securitized, guess what it's starting to behave like? It's starting to behave like a financial asset. That's a why. But this has incredibly dangerous consequences for people's portfolios, right? What's the biggest asset in most Americans' portfolios? If you look at all the holdings they have, in most Americans, where's the bulk of their wealth invested? It's invested in their house. Historically, that was a good thing, right? You had 50% invested in your house, 50% in all of these financial assets. You had a bad year in the market. You could look at it and say, thank God I have my house. It's held up its value. Forget about that now. In a year in which if your financial assets have a catastrophic year, like 2008, guess what your house value is doing in that same year? It's dropping 20% as well. Real estate is no longer acting as a hedge. It's behaving like a financial asset, which means if you want to diversify, you've got to work a lot harder than you did 30 or 40 years ago, where you just say, go buy a house, you're okay. Now you might have to go global, you might have to look for, you might actually have to create securities that are designed just to move in the opposite direction of the market to get diversification. Because the natural diversification you got from real estate seems to have gone away. Something to think about as we start securitizing just about everything under the sun. When you securitize things, they start to behave like financial assets. When they start to behave like financial assets, they lose their diversification benefits. Gold mining companies behave just less like gold and more like other stocks. So you take a commodity that behaves like a commodity and then you securitize it, starts to behave like a financial asset. Any questions? So every risky asset class has a price of risk, and tracking those different price of risk is, I think, a key part of deciding on where to allocate your portfolio. What assets should I hold? One final point about implied premiums, and I'll let them go. I've been flogging this dead dog for a while. I keep pushing for people to use implied premiums. I've been pushing for 30 years, and it's a really hard pitch. And it's not because people don't get the logic, but their pushback is, why are we making such a big deal out of it? I'll give you one version of a pushback I get. I go to an investment bank, I said, look, you know, the implied equity risk premium is 5.2%. And they said, no, we prefer to use a historical premium for stocks over T-bills of 8.18%. And I said, that doesn't look right. They said, that's okay. We all use 8.18%. This defense is, if we all use the same number, it doesn't matter what the right number is. So let me ask you a question. If everybody in an investment bank is using 8.18% as their equity risk premium to value stocks, and the implied premium is 5.2%, what are you going to find on every stock that you value, stock after stock after stock? Every stock, the value is going to get pushed down. You're going to say, don't buy that stock, don't buy that stock, don't buy that stock, don't buy. Nothing will look good. I mean, if the market is pricing in 5.2%, you put in a much higher price for risk, you're going to push up the cost of equity, push up the cost of capital, push every stock off the buy. So you know what tends to happen in investment banks? The equity research department ends up using 2 to 3% premiums because that way they can put out buy after buy after buy after buy. So you can actually, one year I went through Goldman Sachs with six different departments and checked with each one what they were using as equity risk premiums. It was amazing how the numbers varied and how you could predict which number was going to be used depending on what the bias was for that particular group. It's a recipe for disaster. I'm not saying you need to use 5.2%, but I think you have an obligation to at least come up with your own way of coming up with a dynamic forward-looking premium that reflects the market as it exists today. So if I use too high a premium, everything is going to look, overvalued. I'm not buying that. If I use too low a premium, everything's going to look cheap. And that's part of the reason at least getting a sense of what is that number I should be at least around So if you're using 5%, I'm not going to say you're wrong and I'm right. 5% is close enough. We can move on. So when you turn in your DCF and I see a 2% equity risk premium, I'm not going to freak out. I'm just not going to look at the rest of your valuation. And here's why. With a 2% equity risk premium, your destination is preset. What are you going to find? The stock is cheap. Buy it. But you're not asking me to buy the stock because you like it. You're asking me to buy the stock because you think the S&P 500 should really be at 6,000, right? Because that's the implicit number you get. If that's what you believe and you're right, what the heck are you doing wasting your time valuing individual stocks? Go just buy an S&P 500 futures contract and you're going to get incredibly wealthy. Don't make every valuation you do a joint test of both what you think about the company and what you think about the market. But that's exactly what you're doing. When you use an equity risk premium, very different from the implied premium. Yeah?
Is it possible that the market is inefficient to the extent that you have different equity risk premiums per industry?
No, it's not inefficiency. In fact, if you don't like betas, remember the way we take the market premium and we come up with cost of equity for sectors is we have different betas for different sectors. Let's say you don't trust betas. There's another way in which you can come up with cost of equity for a company, right? You can go each sector, what I did for the S&P 500, for the energy sector, for the consumer, and you will actually get an implied cost of equity for each sector. And you can use that to value every company in that sector and never have to use betas. So it's a different way of approaching getting cost of equity for companies. Say, look, I don't trust betas and all this crap. I'm just going to go with implied cost. It is actually a very model agnostic way of computing cost of equity. You don't have to defend portfolio theory and CAPM and betas. You're just saying this is what the market is requiring as a rate of return for consumer product companies, and I'm going to use it for every consumer product company. In fact, I've considered doing an implied cost of equity by sector. What stopped me is my laziness. Because the data is there, especially with the S&P, because they break down with capital IQ, I can get the cash flows and the growth rates for each sector. I should do this. I mean, it's worth the trouble because you can get an implied cost and at least check to see whether your betas are within shouting distance or what the reality is. So it's actually something that you can do with not just the U.S. but with any market. One final point is every year I spend about 2 weeks updating a paper. I won't even call it a paper. It's a really, really boring manuscript on equity risk premiums. Where I basically take everything I know about equity risk premiums and I vomit it out. And it's about 125 pages. I'll send you the link. I'm sure all of you will start reading it right away. But basically, I start off and look, these are the different ways in which equity risk premiums can be estimated. You can do a historical, you can do a survey, you can do the implied. And then at the end, I say, look, let's not lose sight of what we're trying to do. With all of these different ways of estimating equity risk premiums, I'm trying to forecast a future premium. So I close the paper by asking a simple question. All these different approaches people are using, which one is the best predictor of future stock returns? Because ultimately, once I do that, I've found the best estimate. So I tried four. So in my race, I ran four different horses. First, I had the current implied premium every year, and I said, I can use that. The second is I took the implied premium for the last 5 years and averaged out, some kind of smoothing. The third was the historical premium, which 80% of people still use. And the fourth was a very simplistic approach. If you remember that graph that I showed you for the default spread versus the equity risk premium, if you look at the last 60 years of data, the equity risk premium in the U.S. has been roughly twice the default spread. It's a very simplistic calculation. Numbers move around, obviously. So if your default spread is 2%, then the equity risk premium is roughly 4%. So I said, I'm going to use that very soon. So I took these four approaches, and I then looked to see which one best predicted return. First, the implied premium the next year, because that's. But also what the actual returns were in the next 5 years and next 10 years. So if you have a really good predictor, first, would you expect to see a positive correlation or a negative correlation? You want a positive correlation. When the premium is high, you should get high returns. And already you can see one horse limping out of the gates, never really making it. If there's one risk premium you should never use, which one should be the non-starter here? Look at this. This is a perverse way of estimating risk premiums. The historical premium is high. My actual returns are low. The historical premium low. So if there's one premium that's not even in the race, it's historic. So I'm crossing that out. The other three are all reasonable contenders. In fact, even the default spread multiplied by 2 does better than a historical premium. Think of how easy that is. And whenever I'm tempted to look at an existing implied premium, say, maybe I should be averaging things out. If you compare the implied to the average, it turns out that the current implied premium is a better predictor on every level than an average premium. So when I feel the urge, maybe I should be smoothing things out. I look at this table and say, maybe I should not. Because it turns out that when I try to smooth things out, it doesn't give me a better predictor. So my argument for an implied premium is not some high-level theory argument. There's very little theory here. It's an internal rate of return. It's just pragmatic. Historically, it's done a better job of forecasting future returns. And if that's our job in valuation, we should be using a current implied premium. It doesn't have to be mine. You have the spreadsheet. You can change the numbers you don't like on growth and cash flows. But it should be some version of a forward-looking premium. One nice thing about implied premiums, you can do them for any market. So as an example, in 2010, I was valuing, I think it was Tata Motors, isn't it? You know how we usually compute risk premiums for a country? We start at the U.S. premium, then we look at the rating and the default spread. So we go through this entirely tortured exercise. I said, what if I don't believe in any of that stuff? I don't trust ratings agencies. Could I compute an implied premium for the Indian Equity Index? Because after all, that's really what I should be using. So in September of 2007, I took the level of the index. I took just the dividends in the previous year, saying, what about buybacks? Indian companies did not buy back stocks. So basically, I just counted the dividends because there were no buybacks. The growth rate was set equal to the growth rate. And here's where I got, this is the number I had the most trouble with the Indian equities. In the US, getting a top-down estimate for the S&P 500 earnings growth is pretty easy to do. It's the most tracked and followed index in the world. Getting that top-down growth rate for the Sensex for the next 5 years is really, really, really difficult to do. And I cheated. About half of the stocks in the Sensex have ADRs or GDRs listed in the new. So you know what I did? Those companies tend to have analysts projecting growth. So I built up to a growth rate for those companies, and then I extrapolated to the rest of the index. So it's the weakest link in this calculation. I came up with 14% in rupee terms. The growth rate beyond year 5 is equal to the risk-free rate then, which was 6.76%. And I solved for a required rate of return. And what I got as my internal rate of return was 11.18%. At least in 2007, based on how Indian stocks were being priced, if you ask me, what's the risk premium for India? I would subtract out the T-bond rate from, or the Indian government bond rate from it, and get a 4.42% premium. Incidentally, that premium was actually slightly lower than the premium for the U.S. You think that doesn't make any sense? Remember, within each market, you can get a risk premium that deviates from this, especially in countries like India and China, where investors are restricted to investing just in domestic markets for the most part. You can get equity risk premiums in India and China that fall well below what a global investor should be accepting. You might have no choice as an Indian investor because you're forced to invest domestically. That doesn't mean you can ask me to invest in that equity risk premium because I have choices. But doing an implied premium lets you look to see when a market's essentially being pushed up because domestic investors are being driven to invest only in that market. And that would then become your equity risk premium for India. I've also done this. I've been doing this for the Bovespa now for quite a few years. So you can actually... The way to read this is the red part is my equity risk premium for the U.S. The green is the additional amount I was demanding for Brazil because... So I'm computing the implied equity risk premium for the Bovespa versus the S&P 500. In 2000, the equity risk premium for the S&P 500 was about 2.2%. The additional amount, I was demanding a huge spread for investing in the Bovespa. That number decreased, in little blips, by September 2007, you can see the additional premium charging for Brazil is down to a tiny amount. Then you get the 2008 crisis, it pops up. Again, by 2012, people have forgotten that there's country risk in Brazil. It's down to a tiny amount. It's every 5 or 6 years you get a reminder that Brazil is not quite yet a developed market. You get it in the form of one scandal or the other, one crisis or the other. It's a great way to track how markets kind of shift over time based on how people are pricing stocks. One final table and then we'll be done. As you know, on my website, I collect data on all publicly traded companies at the end of every year, so the 2020 update is up. There are 43,000 companies, and every year for the last 20 years, I've actually divided my data into developed and emerging markets, And I'll confess, I've been pretty lazy about my classification. It's based on geography. So Europe I've treated as developed, and Asia is, much of Asia outside of Japan is emerging, though you could argue that there are parts of Europe that are a lot more emerging than parts of Asia in terms of risk. So based on the geography, here's what I do. I take my developed market companies, I compute an implied, just like I did for the S&P 500, an implied cost of equity for those companies, and I do the same thing for